House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome back. We are here for our fast and furious 35 days. I know that the days are really full, but our agendas are really full, so we really do need to start right at 1 when we can. And I think I mentioned before, in terms of our work plan, we have a lot of reports that we're going to be receiving after we finish working through the bills. So don't look ahead on your calendars and think after the first chamber deadline that House Ed will not be meeting. So please do not schedule meetings, golf, et cetera, from 1 to 3 on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But if you all come, we can talk about Valentine's Day, okay? So I'm going to open an organizational meeting. Richard, could you describe the committee rules for us, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The committee rules are very similar to the rules that we've been operating under thus far. They're short session rules, so there's a couple of things that I wanted to point out to the committee. And one is Section 15 of the rules, and the other is Section 17. They deal with minority reports and conflicts of interest, respectively. And the big thing that I want the committee to note is that the timelines are moved up. So if there's a minority report, intention to file a minority report has to be given to committee staff by 5 p.m. that day that the committee took action on the measure, and the report has to be finished within by 5 p.m. the next day. So because the timelines are compressed, the minority report schedule is similarly compressed. And for conflict, Section 17, committee member actually has to address their conflict in committee. As per normal House rules, they have to say that they have a conflict of interest. But that's about it. Otherwise, it's good business as usual.
Any questions about the rules? Seeing none, Representative Springer, would you move adoption of the rules?
Sure. Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the rules, the House Committee rules, House Committee on Education rules.
Representative Springer moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2014. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we're all here with one absent.
She's coming.
Let's see. Next, we are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4008. Could you briefly describe the bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the first public hearing for House Bill 4008, and it revises the method by which the state school fund grants and school improvement fund grants for youth corrections education programs and the juvenile detention education programs are calculated.
Thank you very much. So first up, we have Jan McComb and Christine Kirk, please. May you...
Yeah.
So should I bring them all three up at the same time? I was just looking at that arrow. Does Tori Lynn want to come up at the same time, too?
I was just curious if he was on there.
That makes sense. No, he's due to three. Welcome. And thank you all for helping a couple of us have some really great tours lately.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll kick this off by giving you a little bit of context and background. The Oregon Department of Education is responsible for educating the youth housed in youth corrections, which is staffed and operated by the state, and juvenile detention, which is operated by the counties. Youth housed in youth correction facilities have been adjudicated and sentenced. The average stay there is about a year. Last school year, there were about 1,200 individual youths who were housed in a youth correction facility. And on any given day, there were about 479 YSEP students. Juvenile detention facilities, on the other hand, are where students go where they've been detained by law enforcement, but most have not been through the court system yet. Their average stay is about 8.2 days. Last school year, there were over 3,000 youths that passed through the JDEP facilities, and on any given day, they averaged about 195 youths. These numbers represent a lot of instability in the enrollment as kids move in and out. In the relatively distant past, ODE provided the teachers for these facilities, but we now contract those out, and ESDs and school districts bid on those contracts. They're funded through the state school fund and are based on weighted enrollment, just like other kids in regular school districts.
Youth correction kids get a weight of 2, and juvenile detention kids get a weight of 1.5. The Department of Ed's had some trouble keeping our contractors, in part because of the instability of funding. The enrollment fluctuation kind of plays havoc on these small schools, and if you're from a small school district, you might, you know, recognize that. It doesn't seem like it's a big deal to lose a couple of students, but in a really small school, that could mean a teacher. Another thing to keep in mind is that these programs have a longer school year. They're there for 11 months, and so they have to take their state school fund dollars and stretch them further. Students in these programs are usually the most at-risk students in the state and are typically well below grade level in academics and behind in credits for graduation. The lack of predictability in funding makes it an unstable place to work and feel secure in a job, even just for a year. Correctional settings are not the easiest places in which to recruit teachers, and being able to know that the funding is stable for the upcoming year is really important for those folks. Kids suffer from the unpredictability, too. The kids being served are the ones where school and relationships haven't really been previously successful. And losing your teacher mid-year can be very disruptive. In short, the funding method is hard on the program, it's hard on the teachers, and it's hard on the kids. The proposed solution in this bill is to allow these programs the option of extended ADMW. Extended ADMW is when the schools have the option of taking this year's enrollment or last year's enrollment on which to base their funding. All the other school districts have that option now, and so this isn't really a big change. But that would give these programs enough time to plan ahead for when they know there are going to be budget cuts, and so they don't have to make these mid-year layoffs. The Department of Ed introduced the same bill last session, and it supports it now. And again, this would be a relatively minor change, but it would give a lot of predictability in the funding for these programs.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelsler, Vice Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Springer, and committee members. Thank you very much for having us here and for supporting and bringing forward House Bill 4008. I'd also like to extend our appreciation to our partners at the Oregon Department.
Can you start by introducing yourself for the record?
I'm Christine Kirk with the Oregon Youth Authority, and I am the Public Policy and Government Relations Manager. I'd like to extend our appreciation also to our partners. As was mentioned, the educators in our facilities are contracted, and they're contracted through the Oregon Department of Education. We have 7 educational service providers within our 10 facilities across the state. The Oregon Youth Authority Director, Fairbors Pashkaretz, submitted a written letter for today. That letter conveyed that education plays a paramount role within our facilities. We feel that it is not just something that we're required to do, but something that is vital to the success of our youth while they're in our custody in terms of their stability as well as their ability to integrate into the community. We strive to create a stable, safe environment in a real school setting for our youth in our care. When schools experience mid-year reductions, that works against our ability to provide a stable relationship and environment for the youth. One of the things included in the director's letter is an article from the Statesman's Journal on October 2, 2013. That article covers recent changes that were implemented at our 2 Willamette Valley facilities for boys, Hillcrest and McLaren. Today, testifying will be Keith Usery from the Willamette Education Service District, and he can further articulate what happened in October of this year when we experienced a rather large mid-year service reduction. Our conclusion is that extended ADMW is a valuable component of operating a school and providing stability when we see fluctuating population levels through a year. Thank you very much for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelsler, members of the committee. My name is Tori Lynn. I'm the director for the Linn County Juvenile Department. I'm also here today representing the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to be before you again today about this important issue. I have submitted written testimony electronically on behalf of the Directors Association. Also wanted to take the opportunity to add some additional comments to that. I think it's important to understand the youth that we're talking about, and you heard a little bit about that from the comments that were presented previously. These are kids that generally have had very little success in public school settings. They've been pushed out of the regular school system, often for very good reasons, because their behaviors are often hard to deal with. It may have been one large event. It may have been many small events that led to their changes in placement. Parents don't place a high value on education. They're poorly supervised, often lagging behind, as you heard earlier, in math and reading skills. Oftentimes inadequately assessed for educational needs, and that may be because they're not in school for much of the time, either skipping or that families move quite a lot. So why should you care? You know, these kids have done something that's gotten them placed into a correctional type of setting. These youth don't really have adults in their lives that are advocating for them. I don't think you're going to see any parents today testifying on behalf of their children in these programs. These are youth who, you know, drop out of school. If they drop out of school, they'll have a much higher degree and likelihood of being involved in our criminal justice system. These kids are very intelligent. They have many skills and talents. Oftentimes they've been misguided and misled by the adults in their lives that they depend upon. Many of these youth have suffered tremendous traumas in their lives, having parents that have been incarcerated, poverty, loss of a parent through divorce or death, and abuse. Detention facilities provide an opportunity for change. Youth and families in crisis are much more likely to be motivated to make changes in their lives. They have an opportunity to be assessed and of their educational strengths and deficits. Each youth works individually based upon that assessment. They have personal instruction because our classrooms are fairly small. Now the question can come up, kids are only there for a short period of time, as you heard. My particular facility, it's just over 7 days that kids may be there. So why is this important? Why is this education piece important? Experiencing success in an educational setting, this may be the first time they're able to do that in a detention setting. Students get excited about learning, firm believer in the saying that kids do well when they can. Given the opportunity and the supports around them, kids are going to do well and make good choices and learn as we would like all of our kids to do. The current problem, I think, has been identified with the instability of being able to plan from the beginning of the school year to the end of the school year. It's not just a large county or a large facility problem. It's actually, I think, more... has bigger impact on smaller facilities because, for example, in my facility, I have a half-time teacher and a full-time instructional assistant. As that teacher time gets cut, that supervision of the instructional assistant stays the same, but the teacher's there less, so the supervision is less of the teacher, as well as, you know, the instructional assistant becomes kind of the primary educator in this, and they're not certified. So we would certainly, the Directors Association would certainly support House Bill 4008. I was also told this morning the Association of Oregon Counties has met this morning with their public safety meeting. They discussed this bill. They're also in support of this bill. I think it's a good beginning to looking at this problem and coming up with some solutions that will help these kids in this situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the testimony, Jan. I was particularly fascinated with your testimony that we are recruiting teachers, not the students, and that was a good sign. Sorry, I had to highlight that for you. You had mentioned that you had brought this up in 2013. The department did as a bill. What did we do or not do? I mean, it's clear what we didn't do, but why? What happened?
Kirk Gelser, Representative Huffman. I think there was a reluctance in 2013 to do anything that touched on the state school fund. And so we couldn't really generate enough interest going into 2013. So there really actually weren't any hearings on the bill at all.
And okay. I think something that's really important to clarify, this actually does not touch change the distribution formula of the state school fund. It's just a matter of equity to treat these schools in the same way we do every other school in the state.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, that's you brought up a question because I was going to ask why wasn't this part of the work group that I know that Representative Springer is involved in the school distribution formula. You're saying it's not involved in it, but it is a distribution formula issue.
So I think that the distribution formula issue that they're discussing there is what are the different weights that you give to kids? How do you decide based on which kids are in a district or a school? What are you sending? This really has to do with the way that you report the number of kids that you have in your district. And this is these are the only facilities that don't benefit from the same calculation as everybody else. So there, we've heard there's not going to be a fiscal on the bill. It's not changing the way the monies are moving, and it's also not having an additional weight for these students. And there was a bill last session that talked about that, and it became very confusing just because of the interplay of all those different issues. Any other questions? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Help me understand the timing here a little better. The bill takes effect in July. It affects the grants requested for the 2014-15 school year. When would people start applying for these grants that we're about to change the weighting on?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Gomberg, they wouldn't necessarily apply for as a grant. They would go into the 2014 school year, and I believe they do an October 1 count and December 1 count. And they would look at their numbers for 2014 and say, how many kids do we have? And if they have more kids than the prior year, then they would use this year's numbers, and they really wouldn't need this bill. But if they had fewer kids, then they could use last year's numbers, and it would be the same fiscal impact as this year, so there would be, for this coming year, no fiscal impact. Does that make sense?
I think so. I'll accept it. How's that?
Representative Wisnett.
Well, Madam Chair, so this we're talking about declining enrollment again, and we're talking about phantom students that I've approached this chamber before about. So you are affecting the money in the pot.
So, Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnett, yes, in the future, it might very well affect the money in the pot. Otherwise, these folks wouldn't be here. For this coming year, it doesn't affect the money in the pot. But if in the coming years they continue to see declining enrollment, then they'll be able to use the prior year's numbers. And so that will affect it. I jotted down a few of the fluctuations we've seen just in the recent past, just to get a kind of a handle on how much that would be. And for the 2012-13 school year, there were 292 students in the county program. And in 2013-14, there were 258. So that's a difference of 34 students. For the youth corrections program, the number of students dropped from 874 to 706, a 77 student difference. So we're not seeing really huge wide swings. And again, this is going back 2 years and looking at what we expect to see. So it probably will have a fiscal impact in the coming years, but it won't be huge.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one gets two and one gets 1.5. Can you tell me how the Youth Correction Authority and Juvenile Justice, how are they using that additional money to help these special needs or these youth that are getting education? How is that being? If you don't, the school distribution formula, we give 1.5 for non-English-speaking students, But that money is not transparent. It's not accountable as far as using it to do what it was given extra money to do, what the school districts were given extra money to do. So how do you use your additional funds that you're asking for per weighted student?
So Representative Gelser, Representative Wisnett, I would probably defer to the people who work in the Youth Corrections Education Program, but just comment that, as Representative Wisnett points out, the weight is treated similarly to other weights in the system, where it's not, we don't require an accounting of how they spent the money, make sure that they spent it on those kids in certain ways. We leave it up to their discretion, and that's a policy decision for you all, and I think the School Funding Task Force is taking a look at that.
Thank you. Did you want to reply to the
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett? I think within the juvenile, county juvenile departments, I think the extra weight, as I had previously stated in my testimony, many of the youth that we see have various problems in their lives, special education needs. And so as those youth come into our facilities, they're evaluated. If they have an IEP from their home school, they're working on the IEP. We have to follow those same rules that a school district would have with any youth on an IEP, transferring that back to the school when they leave our facilities. It's a very high need population, as I'm sure you're aware. And so having that extra time of a teacher being there and trying to really re-engage that youth in the educational system that, for whatever reason, is failing them, or they're failing the system, however you want to look at that, trying to get that re-engagement for them and get them excited about learning, and so that when they leave our facilities, we connect them back into the schools and are able to provide some supervision to help them kind of maintain their attendance and some of the things that maybe were causing problems for them.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you for your response, and I understand what you're saying, and I understand these children are, you know, come from situations that require a lot. But, you know, as someone accounting for the tax money, we're giving you twice the number for some and one and a half for the other. Maybe the solution and accountability and transparency that this body could look at is you need a good teacher, but you also maybe need counseling. You need a professional counselor to come in and teach them how to, you know, change their lifestyle and things like that. So, you know, we're not going to change it here today, and I'll probably vote for the bill, but I hope that this committee that the chair has appointed, that they'll look at the distribution formula. I'm working with the Oregon Advocacy Commission that I think we're going to talk about introducing a bill next full session to say we want accountability of what the school districts are doing with that money for English. We're not getting ahead, ladies and gentlemen. That's costing the school system a lot of money for non-English speaking students. And we're giving you one and a half times. What are you doing with that money? I think that money needs to be transparent and accountable in school districts of how they're addressing English as a second language.
Are you, and I know that's a little beyond the topic of this bill, but are you talking about those issues in your school funding task force?
Yes. In fact, we're narrowing the scope of what we're going to be talking about, and certainly a fundamental piece of that is equity, and we've spent quite a bit of time on trying to establish what equity means and what that represents as far as the group, and that's a piece of it. Keep in mind the task force is about how the funds are distributed, period. And so I certainly am hearing everything that you're saying there, and that is part of the conversation, but truly the task of the task force is how these monies are distributed.
All right, thank you. Any further questions for this panel? We have another panel to go on this bill. All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Next we have Kevin Hunking, Keith Ushery, and Jessica Adamson, please. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you.
And you can start in any order you want, as long as you start by introducing yourself for the record, please.
My name's Kevin Hunking. I'm with Multnomah Education Service District, and I'm the principal for Multnomah Donald E. Long Detention Center, as well as Yamhill Detention Center. Oak Creek in Albany Youth Correction Facility Education, and Camp Florence. I would just like to point out that I really support the bill and feel that it brings stability to a very, hard-to-target budgeting issue. All the school districts have extended ADMW already. The juvenile detention and youth corrections education programs do not. So therefore, we start in July with one set budget amount. And you know that very good education requires very good planning. So we plan out the year, we plan out our staff and the engaging activities. We get rolling, and along comes December, and then we get this mail that states they're going to adjust our budget and retro it back to July 1, so it really ends up being about at least double the cut. And so then we have to suddenly adjust and try and overcome that, and then they adjust it again at the end of June, and then that just continues to roll and roll. So this House bill will actually help to stabilize that. It really just brings equality to the students. The students come directly from a school district to us. They might go back to the school district in their own county, or they might go on from a juvenile detention to a youth corrections facility. But either way, this just allows it to become more of an equality, an equal, stable setting. So I really ask that you support this bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Keith Usry, and I am the Director of School Improvement and Instructional Services at Willamette Education Service District. And our agency contracts with the Oregon Department of Education to operate the schools at Hillcrest Youth Corrections Facility here in Salem, McLaren Youth Correction Facility in Woodburn, Linn County Juvenile Detention Center in Albany, and the Marion County Juvenile Detention Center also here in Salem. And first, I'd like to express my gratitude to Chair Gelser for moving this Bill 4008 forward. I believe that would provide great stability for a system right now that is in no better way to describe it than in crisis at times. By the very nature of the student populations in youth corrections facilities and detention centers, they're subject to major swings in enrollment, and that will just depend upon the number of students who or the number of young men and women who are arrested or convicted of crimes and placed in those facilities. So it's not nearly as stable as a local community might be. However, traditional school districts have the benefit of extended ADMW, and we're not asking for additional resources. We're only asking for the same treatment as a traditional school district. I think to illustrate a bit further in terms of the double weight, it's important to note that more than 50% of the students in our settings right now are on an IEP. They have a special education need. Many of them are teen parents, which would also receive double weight, and many of them are ESL students as well. So in terms of the double weight, you also have to consider that we're looking at a much longer school year. We're looking at 220 days versus maybe 190 or 180 in a regular school district. So there are additional costs that go along with running these facilities. I want to give you an illustration just to help try and make it clear the impact of retroactive adjustments to contracts. So I'm going to do something hypothetical for a moment just to make it clear if I can. Let's assume that it's a youth corrections education program with 100 students, and the program sees a sharp decline in enrollment. Say 25 students are now gone, which is not all that uncommon, and there are circumstances this year that would match that. That would be a 25% reduction in student population, and it would be a loss of about $310,000 in revenue for what amounts to a very small school. But because the reductions are made retroactively to the beginning of the fiscal year, we see a 125% reduction across the entire fiscal year. So you go backwards, and not only do you have to essentially make cuts going forward that capture the revenue that was spent in the previous quarter, you have to make those additional cuts going forward. So it amplifies that. So in this case, we would see an increase from a 25% reduction in revenue to more than 30% in revenue just because the way that the ADMW or the absence of ADMW affects this particular system. I believe it's an issue of equity for these students who are among the most at risk in our state. It is a it's a mystery, I guess, in terms of why it's taken this long in order to bring the conversation forward. But again, we're not asking for more. We're just asking for equal treatment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson, and I'm here today on behalf of Youth Rights and Justice. Since 1975, YRJ has represented tens of thousands of youth in the juvenile justice system and thousands of youth in the education system. And what we know about these kids is that they have extraordinarily high needs. As you've heard today, these kids are more likely to change schools more often. They are more likely to miss critical instruction days. And they are more likely to have been excluded from school as a result of suspension or expulsion. What we also know, which is most interesting, is that these kids are 3 to 6 more times more likely to be in need of special education services than the general student population. They also have extraordinary emotional needs as a result of trauma and issues with the reasons why they're in the facilities to begin with. We support 4008 as a small step forward in terms of equity and making investments that are critical to the education of these youth who already face significant challenges and need a strong education in order to move forward and better their lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Fagan.
I don't know that my question is for this panel. It's a question that finally has occurred to me, so that someone from ODE might be a better person to answer it. But just kind of a technical, you guys have done a great job presenting why we need to serve these students. Just as a technical matter, because I've served on the school board, the retroactive piece strikes me as very odd. That's, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's not what happens on a typical school board with our ADMW. You don't ever, you know, if those students were to leave halfway through the year, the school board doesn't then lose the money that they had budgeted. So is that a technical piece that, I mean, that's what I'm hearing you say. I just wanted to confirm, but that's not how I understand that it works for other school, for school districts for ADMW. Or even somebody on the panel might be able to confirm for me. It's just a technicality of the school funding formula that I want to make sure that I understand.
Chair Gelser and Representative Fagan, you're correct. Okay. That isn't the way it happens in a traditional school district. And that's part of the issue of being a contractor, is that we're given an amount based upon the number of students to fund the programs for the year. But then that amount is adjusted based upon the current enrollment, and it's adjusted at least twice per year.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Gorsuch.
Okay, so feeding off of that, I guess I'm not functioning well today, but I don't understand why anyone would come up with a plan that would, I see the adjustment, but where was the rationale to say, go back to the original starting point? Where did that come from? Do you know?
We just want to change it.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems incredibly illogical to me. And it makes sense if you have a reduction as you move forward to say, okay, now we have 25 less students, so we're going to pull back on that. But I'm mystified as to why we would go retroactive.
I'm sure it's the first time we've ever pondered something that seems illogical in
our
school funding system. Any other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 4008? Nope. Going, gone. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4008. We had not posted this for work session today because we don't have the paperwork back today, but we should have the paperwork back on Wednesday. That's true for all. We don't have paperwork on any bills today. As soon as we have the paperwork, my intention is to move the bill hopefully on Wednesday, and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means has been removed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, the advisory opinion had subsequent referral for Ways and Means, but it has been rescinded and there is no subsequent referral.
So it'll go straight to the floor after we have the opportunity to vote on it on Wednesday.
This is all we get?
That's all you get? What do you mean, this is all you get? I'll bring you a cookie.
Really?
Brownie cookies?
Yeah.
Yes, we have more bills. We're going to move on to the next bill now.
Well, thank you. I thought maybe I misheard.
No. I was just explaining what's going to happen next to this bill. On Wednesday, we'll work the bill.
Thank you.
But right now, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4009. Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 4009 establishes a pediatric nursing facility account in the state school fund and funds that account. This measure springs from a stakeholder group discussion that's been going on throughout this interim, specifically relating to Providence Child Center in Portland. There is some legislative history with funding Providence Child Center. There was a one-year fix, I think, out of the Ways and Means Committee in the last legislative session, and this is a potential more permanent fix for the funding of the facility.
Thank you. We have Pat Budo and David Williams. And anybody else you want to bring with you? Same rule applies. You just have to introduce yourself before you start.
Okay, I'll be first. Chairman Gelser and members of the House Education Committee, my name is Pat Budo, and I'm the Operations Administrator of Providence Child Center. On behalf of Providence Health and Services, as well as the families and children who are served by the Center for Medically Fragile Children at Providence Child Center, we want to register our strong support for this bill. Providence Child Center has been caring for Oregon's most fragile children for over 60 years. We're rooted in our commitment to promote the inherent dignity of all children by providing each child in our care the opportunity to achieve his or her greatest potential and the highest quality of life in an atmosphere of acceptance and love. We're not only a leading facility in the United States for caring for medically fragile children, but we're also an educational leader where families, doctors, and caregivers learn about and exchange new approaches for supporting these kids in living as full a life as possible. We're the only pediatric skilled nursing facility in the Pacific Northwest providing 24-hour long-term, short-term respite and end-of-life care to medically fragile kids and young people with profound disabilities and complex medical needs. Our center has a maximum capacity of 58 children and young adults. And when I talk about young adults, we're talking about 18 to 21-year-olds. The families whose children reside at the center have access to an interdisciplinary team of amazing physicians, nurses, specialists, therapists, and an incredible number of volunteers. These teams monitor the children's condition, administer medication and treatment, and providing leading edge therapies. Parents receive information and support to understand their child's complex medical needs and advocate for their child's best interest. Over the years, the Child Center has been fortunate enough to have a strong partnership with Portland Public Schools to ensure access to quality educational services for the kids in our care. Most of our kids go to school every day, which provides them access to an education, but also the important social opportunity to attend school and interact with their peers. Some of our students, because of their medical constraints or because of parental choice, receive services at the Child Center, again provided in partnership with Portland Public Schools. The importance of the educational services to our kids can't be understated. It's critical to providing our kids as normal a childhood as possible and providing that they can have the opportunity to reach their fullest potential. Last year, Portland Public Schools discovered a gap in the law concerning residency that threatened the opportunity for all of our kids to continue to receive educational services through the district. Our families were very concerned about the impact that this would have on the continuity of their child's education and their quality of life. We appreciated the great work and collaboration of Chair Gelser, Portland Public Schools, and the Oregon Department of Education to develop an interim solution to guarantee continued access to educational services through Portland Public Schools. Today, we're pleased to support House Bill 4009, developed through a collaborative process in the interim, which provides long-term certainty for how the kids that we serve will receive educational services. We want to thank the team at Portland Public Schools, the Oregon Department of Education, the Department Department of Human Services and Representative Gelser for working together to find a solution which meets the needs of each entity, but more importantly, guarantees that our kids will receive the educational services that they need. Providence Health and Services and the families and children that we serve encourage your support and passage of House Bill 4009.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. David Williams with Portland Public Schools, and I have with me Ed Krinkowski, our Assistant Director of Special Education, as well, for questions if they're ones that I can't answer. You know, this bill really is, and Ms. Budo did a great job of laying out the need here. This bill is about ensuring continuity of services, of education services for the students housed at the Providence Child Center, and as well ensuring that those services are equitably paid for. Just a little bit of history. For quite some time, Portland Public Schools has made an assumption about the students at the Providence Child Center that they are, for all intents and purposes, residents of PPS. We claimed them under the state's school funding formula for ADM purposes and submitted to the high-cost disabilities account as necessary to pay for and deliver services in the least restrictive environment to the students housed there. It did come to our attention, however, that the residency statute in Oregon is not as simple as just where the kid lives. The residency statute says that you are a resident of the district in which your parents live. So there are quite a few, in fact, a majority of the students housed at the Providence facility that are not actually residents of Portland Public Schools. So in an effort to ensure that we continue to deliver services while come up with a long-term solution, you'll remember last session we passed a one-year stopgap that basically said, PPS, keep doing what you're doing for this next year. We're going to grandfather in what you did because there was a problem. We had been claiming kids under the state school fund formula for distribution purposes that were not residents of the district, so there was a legitimate issue there. And in the meantime, let's all work together and come up with a more viable solution looking into the future. And Ms. Budo certainly laid that out through the leadership of Chair Gelser and the department and Providence and PPS. We were able to have the solution before you today, which essentially, in a nutshell, says the students are not resident of any individual district. When they are at the Providence Child Center, they are the state's residents, and the state will take responsibility, including the FAPE responsibility, free and appropriate public education, which is a federal responsibility around education and service delivery to special needs students. And the department and the district in which the facility is located, Portland Public Schools, shall enter into a contract to deliver services. So for the students there, this is the most important piece, for the students there, they really won't see any change in education services. So we have two classrooms at Grant High School that service a lot of the high school age students in the facility. We transport them to Grant, then transport them back to Providence. They won't see any different. They won't go to a different spot. Then things won't change. They'll continue to have an IEP process that will determine the best course of education for that kid. So for all intents and purposes, that won't change. What will change is for PPS, it'll be clear to us who holds the FAPE responsibility for the student. No individual district in the state will claim them under the ADM formula. No district will be able to submit to the high-cost disabilities account for reimbursement on this. That will have the positive side effect of actually increasing the reimbursement existing in the high-cost disabilities account for every other district in the state, as we're only paying about 45 cents on the dollar out of a high-cost disabilities account now. But that will all rest with the state, and the Department of Ed will simply draw out of the state school fund an amount sufficient to pay for the delivery of education to these students. We've prepared some information for the Ways and Means Committee, because this does have a subsequent fiscal, that the cost of the program is essentially around $2 million, so this is somewhere averaging about $35,000 per student. Obviously, some are significantly higher based on the services we deliver to those kids. As you know, the high-cost disabilities account kicks in at $30,000. So this is simply for the education services that we deliver to this kid. So this bill will ensure that services continue to be provided to some of our most vulnerable students while making sure that no individual district or individual family is really bearing the financial burden of these education services.
Did you have anything you wanted to add?
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and committee members. My name is Ed Krankowski, Assistant Director of Portland Public Schools Department of Special Ed. Ted did a great job of summarizing the timeline of events, and the only thing I'd add is the emphasis on how this was a true collaborative and working to hopefully a solution that I want to thank you in advance for considering.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel?
Well, first of all, thank everybody for their hard work, and Mr. Williams for keeping us informed as we've gone along. This a year ago, this sounded like one of those, oh my gosh, there's no solution things, and lo and behold, sounds like you have a great solution. So this may be a question that's obvious to everybody else, but we're talking about the cost of service. What's the origin of the cost, or where is that? How is that cost derived, and what sort of things can be charged? Because I don't think it says anything about that. So,
right, you know, that's a great question, Representative Reardon. Chair Gelser, I'm going to let Ed take that. He's got a nice spreadsheet. He can kind of give you just a good sense of what are the big blocks of funds that go to pay for services to these students.
Representative Chair, Chair Gelser and Representative Reardon. The spreadsheet that we outlined and delineated the cost, first we got the classroom cost from the high cost report 2011-12 as an estimate for what we would incur for next year and then 2 years after that with a 5% inflation factor. The breakdown is for occupational therapy, speech and language services, physical therapy, transportation, as well as any additional nursing costs students would receive on site, and also school psychological services that would be provided to students mostly for the purposes of evaluation and eligibility. Did you want to add to that?
No, I think that that's a good sense. Obviously, these are people delivering services to kids, and that's so the biggest costs associated in there are the classroom cost, and that's really so. For instance, as I mentioned, we have two self-contained classrooms at Grant High School, so there are teachers and teachers' aides in that classroom providing services. So essentially, number of kids in that class, total personnel cost in that classroom divided by the number of kids gives you the sort of average classroom cost per kid. So, you know, there's obviously direct instruction, but there's also all of these other OT, PT, and other nursing services that are delivered that the school district is required to provide under a student's IEP.
And with all of those factors, we also looked at the number of slots available at Providence, which there are 58 beds available.
Just to clarify, the bill does kind of narrowly talk about what is allowable for reimbursement. If you look on page 1, line 17 through 19, the department shall be responsible for payment of the cost of educational services provided to students admitted to pediatric nursing facilities program facilities, including any services required under an individualized education program. And we designed that to be very narrow. We're just talking about what would typically be the responsibility of a school district under FAPE. We're not paying for medical care or any of the services that Providence is providing.
Right.
It's just the services that the school district would be responsible for if the student walked into or rolled into any school district in the state.
Okay. I think that's... Thank you. That's very helpful.
Any further questions? Great. Thank you. Anybody else want to be heard on House Bill 4009? Well, thank you. And many thanks to the department that worked very hard on this, and to Providence and Portland. I think it started out as a difficult process, but you all made it really easy. Thanks for the good work. Like the other bill, we don't have the paperwork ready on this yet, so it will be back on Wednesday. And Wednesday is a very full day, so we should all be here right at 1 so we can start voting. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4009 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4062. Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 4062 modifies the standards that the State Board of Education must adopt related to student education records. and it directs the department to provide technical expertise to assist educational institutions in complying with those standards, and it also mandates that the department do risk assessments and issue privacy risk assessments of any data system or any spot where student data and information is stored related to education records.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
That's true.
Members of the committee, we do have one. Sorry, I know this is unorthodox. There is a -1 amendment that'll be in your packet that we received from Representative Frederick's office. That amendment would add language to further prohibit the use of student information for sales, advertising, or marketing purposes. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelsa, members of the committee. Hope you folks are doing well. I'm Lou Frederick from North and Northeast Portland, District 43. I sent everybody information about House Bill 4062 last week, and I'm here to highlight some of that information, answer questions, and provide some more rationale for the bill. I do have one amendment that you mentioned, and there may be others in response to any input from the Oregon Department of Education. House Bill 4062, Privacy and Security of Student Records. Some of you will recall at the end of the 2011 session when an education package was passed, there was a lot of haste in that. I think that's an understatement. Many of the components were not vetted through this committee, or if they were, they weren't voted out of this committee. There was little, if any, policy deliberation on the very complicated bill. I've talked about that in other settings and in reference to other subjects. Part of the education reform push of the last few years has involved the collection of data about kids. You might have seen some headlines today regarding tests for entering kindergartners. I don't know if you saw this or not. They are given 60 seconds to identify as many letters as possible from a chart of 100 letters. Apparently, Beaverton 5-year-olds made it through about 25 letters on an average. Three Oregonian reporters took the same test and made it through 50 to 65. Now, here's the thing. Who decided that this piece of information was a meaningful test of kindergarten readiness? What science is behind it, that, or is there any? Or was a contract let to a vendor and they developed a test and now the kids have to take it and we then lament the sorry state of readiness for our young students? Is the science better for the rest of the test? I have no idea. Now, here's one thing. That piece of information is not written on a paper and used by the teacher to guide instruction, and it's not discarded when its usefulness, if any, expires. It's stored in an electronic database, and that little nugget of information about each kid is retained. Never mind that it might be meaningless. Never mind that the folks who don't know any better may attempt to interpret such a test in a way that the test itself does not support. Now, if I were to write a bill that I really wanted to see passed, it would require that rigorous, now I want to note that word rigorous, standards of reliability and, more importantly, validity be required of any new program inflicted on our students and teachers. It would be to require that there be an answer to the question, what does this have to do with teaching and learning? Before we invest scarce funds and even scarcer resources of time and attention on these activities. In the case of any testing regimen, we have to get answers to the question, do the results of these tests really mean what we are assuming they mean? To answer that, you need field testing and a variety of other professional vetting. Now, I introduced this bill because both the technology to collect, store, and share data about young people and the drive to use it are running ahead of appropriate safeguards and even running ahead of conscientious policy decisions. These programs are tied to their usefulness to current and future researchers. Ethical guidelines regarding research using human subjects do not fully account for the personal risks that arise from the collection and storage of personal information. There is now a national database designed to gather test results, discipline records, and personal information on students from the earliest age. We all know that the boundaries of privacy and personal autonomy have already been breached in the electronic collection, storage, and sharing of information about us all. The risk of children is far greater. Decisions we make now may determine whether today's third grader can ever shed the ups and downs of childhood. Risks to our children are potentially vast, while the benefits of this database remain nebulous. For me, there is a basic principle. Information should be gathered, stored, and shared for the educational benefit of the student. While I understand and appreciate the drive to amass a trove of information for future research, I also believe that there must be ethical guidelines that prioritize the security of the individual. A person's privacy and autonomy are vital to his or her future well-being. A number of issues remain unsettled. Who has access to that information? Who can correct the information when it's wrong, and how can content be challenged? Can personal identifiers be reliably separated from stored information when it's shared? Will commercial interests gain access to the database for marketing or other purposes? House Bill 4062 would give several common sense expectations to the force of law, including it will require a privacy risk assessment to be part of any proposal to expand student records or allow access by a third party. It will strengthen the requirements for appropriate standards for privacy and security of records, and especially for the personal identifying information associated with those records. It will require the Department of Education to adopt standards related to the collection, retention, and security of student records, and to provide technical assistance to educational institutions to help them comply with those standards. It will require that parents and legal guardians be allowed to view their children's records and challenge and request correction of incorrect information. It will prohibit disclosure of personal identifying information to individuals who are not responsible for the student's educational program. And it will require that student personal identifying information be removed from the record when it is no longer relevant for preparing the student's educational program or supporting the student's application for employment or admission to a post-secondary educational program or institution. Now, these are just the highlights. There's additional detail in the bill. A permanent student record used to be only as permanent as the paper it was written on and accessible as the file cabinet it was stored in. Now records are stored electronically, able to be translated instantly and stored indefinitely. We should all be concerned about amassing data about young people, given the rapidly advancing technology for matching data with personal identifiers and using those matches for purposes not contemplated when it was gathered. For example, should behavior of a seventh grader bear on that person's future college admission or employment? I know we were all angels at that age. I know I certainly was, and I can see the halos on all of you guys. Or should families be bombarded with targeted product ads based on data gleaned from combining student databases with other resources? The law currently provides no recourse to individuals and families that could be harmed in this way. This bill simply codifies some basic preventative measures. Now, it's interesting that having gone down this road as far as we have, it is suggested that this subject needs more study before we can enact safeguards. Meanwhile, as I've said before, data collection, storage, and sharing are running far ahead of policy. It seems to me that the study should have happened first, but it's too late for that. It's also suggested that enacting the kind of safeguards contained in this bill will endanger the longitudinal database, that it will endanger programs designed to provide data to researchers. Which should come first? The safety and security of student privacy or the desires of researchers? This concern suggests that the longitudinal database is incompatible with the basic common sense safeguards included in this bill. If they are incompatible, which one should go? These programs did not come from the sky. They were created by human beings, and human beings can regulate them to protect our kids. I have obtained one amendment, which you have in your packets. It adds a specific prohibition against using student records for sales, advertising, or marketing purposes, and we are studying suggestions from the Oregon Department of Education, and if amendments results, I'll let you know as soon as possible. I want to thank you for considering this bill. I think it's urgent, and frankly, I hope you'll act on it promptly, because the test results are being sent out there nationally right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you got my vote now. Completely okay. Supportive. You know, I'm Mr. Privacy Issue in the House, thanks to the help of one person in the room that has really helped me a lot in that. Curious, I'm trying to read as much as I can and kind of get my head around Common Core. And I know that Common Core does a lot of data collecting. Do you know right offhand, with your work that you've done on this bill so far, any agreement that the state has made in adopting the Common Core standards and thus the testing that goes along with that? Smarter Balance, is that right?
Smarter Balance.
Do you know how agreements that we've made, are there any that we've made for the Common Core, how they fit in with what
what we're trying to slow down here to make sure that students are protected?
Well, there are several things that come to mind for that. One is that I am the Common Core issues are much broader than just this testing. I have some real significant concerns about what they are saying that they're attempting to accomplish and whether they, in fact, have an impact on what we want to have kids learn in the future. I'm less than impressed with what I've seen so far. Let's put it that way. The testing, there are assessments. The kindergarten assessment that I was talking about is in fact being used by a lot of schools to try to identify where the kids are, but it's being used as a baseline in many of those schools, and the kindergarten teachers aren't even getting a chance to see what the test ends up showing. It doesn't make any sense. They're setting up a baseline data point rather than trying to figure out how this actually helps the individual kids. It may be able to show a broad sort of concept, but how it helps an individual kid is another thing. I come from a different sort of approach. When I was a teacher, my approach was to find out what the kids knew and help them understand what they could do with it and what they needed to know. How that would help. This doesn't do that. The many of these tests are not designed that way. They're designed as summative tests rather than formative tests, and that's a huge difference. That's a concern that I have. Related to this data, though, if the data is sitting out there, and you can tell how a child did at kindergarten or third grade or fifth grade or eighth grade, and then you add into that not only their test scores, but you also add in their discipline issues, that's a real concern, and that's what brought this up about for me. I don't want to have a situation where a seventh grader decides to try to, well, not a seventh grader, but somebody graduates from high school and they decide to apply to U of O or OSU, or PSU. I should go through the whole list, but I won't. And the admissions officer, because it's in a state database, can go in and find out how well they did and how many fights they got into when they were in seventh or eighth grade.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you bringing this forward. Did you at all look at the New York law that just recently passed on student privacy? There's a lot of technology industry, I guess, kind of ethicists, if that's the right word, people who are interested in the, you know, what's ethical in technology, and particularly as it relates to student data, who support that New York law. Actually, talking with somebody from a large tech firm about bringing something similar in 2015, so I'm glad we're having the conversation, but really to strengthen that student privacy, and they kind of like the model of the New York law around student privacy with regard to, like, data, but want to actually see it strengthened. So I'm kind of curious if you've looked into that at all, or...
I have looked. I got information about it, but by the time we put some of these things together, that had not really been part of what we were looking at. I want to see that. There are several other states that are looking at privacy issues as well, because frankly, everyone's concerned about where that longitudinal database is going.
Sure. That's right. Thanks. Further questions for Representative Frederick?
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes. Now, you were talking about the concern in the future for the student. My concern also lies not just with that, but also with how might this data be used as the child moves from, say, the kindergarten to the first grade and the first grade to the second grade. I mean, we know that there's a tendency anyway for teachers to kind of talk about different students, but is there a potential problem there as well in terms of building up a database so that then when they're in the third grade, there's a watch out for this kid kind of thing?
Well, that is something. When I was a teacher, that was one of the things that we were always concerned about, because just I had a number of kids, students who of mine who were troubled kids or underachievers, and it turns out they were dyslexic. They had other issues that no one wanted to really deal with, but they had been already identified. So let's give up on these kids early on. That is a significant concern. But it sort of goes to one of the other issues here, and that is that no one can correct the information right now.
Right.
And the ability for parents to be able to go in and say, wait a minute, this is that we discovered that this child was dealing with this particular issue at that time. That's why they weren't able to do this, or let's be real clear about what's going on here. That's not available yet, and we need to be able to have that kind of availability. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for Representative Reardon?
Thank you so much for working on this. It's critical. But then it always raises other questions when you do this. So, as your classroom teacher that you were, if you had a new student that came in during the middle of the year, would you want to know about their past history of endangering others or not?
Well, you'd want to know something about the child. I mean, I remember when I first started teaching, I ended up with a child who I didn't know what some of his issues were. He had a very short attention span, but it wouldn't have been necessarily classified as ADD. He had other issues that he had had as a child before he even got into school. It was good to finally find that out, to be able to help that particular child, but it was directly involved with their educational his educational plan, and I needed to know that. He ended up, as a part of the way that I, the school that I taught at, he ended up teaching a class because he was able to then focus on that particular class and be more strict than I ever would have been with the students that he was teaching. But it does make a difference to know what's going on with the child, and this allows you to have access to what is important educationally for a child, and that's what I'm concerned about.
So that will stay in.
I would think so. Yes, I mean I there are some. I think there's a concern by at least one person that somehow would not allow educators to know what was going on. I don't see that as the case, quite frankly, but. We can argue on that, and I can we can talk with the some of the people who are concerned about that.
Ms. Brandt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have actually two separate questions, issues. Thanks for bringing this, for sure. So as I think this through, and I'm trying to think of a practical application, so a student has, early on in their educational career, has some learning issues. And nobody knows why, they just have some issues. And let's say math early on. And then later on, 2 years, 5 years, however many years down the road, it becomes, they become aware that the kid is, say, colorblind. So these math issues, when math, the foundation of math learning is color grouping,
right.
Perhaps. If it had been done in shapes, things would have been fine. Now that it's done in colors, maybe it's not so fine. So however many years, 4 or 5 years down the road, they say, oh, it's colorblind. I wonder if that was an issue back here. And so then are we trying to create a process to go back here and say maybe these math issues were related to this? I'm trying to connect all the dots, and I'm not seeing how we can get there.
Well, I'm not suggesting that we get rid of all records of what's mm-hmm. happening with a child, and I think it's important to be able to have that kind of information. I just think that we should have it should be clear who has access to the information, and how we track it after when it has no relationship to their educational component, and that it is not necessarily that the personal identifying information isn't passed along to the inappropriate people. That's what we're talking about. No, you have to be able to do that. One of the best schools, and I'll just brag about it, Astor Elementary School, if you get a chance, up in North Portland, it's not in my district, so I can brag about it without any official problem, is noted for being careful on identifying and working with every child, with having at least three adults constantly looking at every child. And as a result, they keep doing very well, not just in terms of test scores, but quite frankly, they do well further on, their kids do very well in the high school and further on. But they track them. They're keeping track of what they're doing. The real question then becomes, where does all that information go? And that's what this is trying to address. If it's going out into the general, into a national database, then we need to be real careful about that. And I want to set up some kind of parameters for that.
Representative Pierce.
Thanks. Well, you know, and Frederick, I haven't read your bill. I mean, one of the things that's interesting concern to me on the longitudinal and who owns the data is, you know, it kind of reminds me of SOTA contracts, when schools entered into SOTA contracts, and they said, well, we'll get you a scoreboard and we'll set you up with, you know, coolers and whatever, and so we're going to give you this stuff up front. In this case, we're going to give you technology up front, but on the back end, you know, you're locked into that contract. And what's happening, I think, or where people are concerned and some of these privacy ethicists are concerned is that in those contracts, if they're not very well put together and school districts got locked into contracts that they couldn't get out of, is that it's not just the longitudinal data on the surface that, you know Max Parrish and here's his information, but it's the mining of that data and how that can be then used for other purposes, and particularly when we're on, you know, any kind of free platform. And so I think there's a lot of people right now really interested, and particularly as Common Core does require some of this longitudinal data, is to start to get their hands around the management and the back end of that data through, you know, either state laws or helping school districts with better contracts, so that that data isn't easily mined and then, you know, pick up the things that you've learned about my child and then turn around and put them into, you know, a package deal because you also might have his Facebook account and send, you know, targeted ads to my kids. And that's real concerns for, I think, some of the people. And that's not to say all the providers who are private technology that school districts get support from are bad, but there certainly is a question and a line, and I think that we're starting to butt up against that. And that's, so again, I don't know how much your bill deals with that, but I think that's what I'm hearing you say is kind of that underlying, we still need data. It's like mealtime. We use that software, you know, or it's free lunch software. It tracks to the student ID. The school lunch ladies don't see that, but somewhere somebody knows that this ID number targets this kid. But that's really, you know, kind of between the food service director, you know, and maybe a couple others in the school district and not every personnel. And so I think that's where some of this back-end kind of tracking of kids is going to have to go, is that the privacy of the children, you know, have the data available for longitudinal tracking. I can use that to provide to USDA. Here's how many lunches got, you know, fed in a year, but it doesn't say that Johnny had a sandwich. So, and so there's that privacy component, and I think we're pushing up against the boundary of technology that is coming so fast that if we're not thoughtful about how we respond to it, whether it's this piece of legislation or one, you know, in 2015, or you know, or companies having their own person who's their privacy ethics person saying, hey, company, we're pushing the boundaries here. Not everybody hires that individual. And I know one from a large tech company who I won't name yet, who I've talked with, is the person who's kind of the bell ringer in his community and gets a lot of pushback even from his own company. Mm-hmm. So I think that, am I hearing that?
You are right on target. And the, one of the concerns that I have is that with the, some of the private companies, some of the vendors, is that if there's a problem, who do you go to? What happens then? I mean, we're seeing this on a much larger scale with some of the other hacking that's taken place. But we don't know who that, you know, if suddenly you start to get lots of Mattel toy ads directed at your particular youngster, and he, because they found out that he likes trucks. How is that happening? Well, is that coming from, you know, a commercial, or is that coming from this data information? Because he decided to, you know, he did well on a particular test that or question that dealt with trucks. I mean, we don't want to get that far, and we need to get the parameters set up early, and that's what this is attempting to do.
And just to follow up, is just emails, student emails. I mean, there's a lot of technology. It's not just the data. It's any of these platforms that are being made available. You know, again, unless we're thoughtful about it, you know, there's a lot of different ways to mine data and make that aggregated and then put out. So I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and the rest of the committee. I apologize for not going through all the protocol and saying chair and representatives. Appreciate it. If there are any other questions.
Representative Reardon has a question, and we've got a whole bunch of people still signed up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So after your question.
Do you see a case where there would be a burden placed on districts to go back and clean up files retroactively?
Or just, you know, that's frankly a very good question. I think what we're trying to do right now is get things set up before they have to deal with that. I mean, this is we haven't We haven't finished the smarter balance test yet. It hasn't reached completely into the longitudinal database, the national longitudinal database. So I'm trying to preempt that if we can. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Frederick. So we have a lot of people and not a lot of time. So everyone's going to be at about 3 minutes. Is that workable for folks? Because there's another committee in this room and they will close out. So next I have Rex Higgins, Betsy Salter, and Becky Strauss.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Chair Gelzer, Representative Rudin, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Rex Higgins, and I was a seventh grade angel. Actually, I'm one of the co-founders of Oregon Save Our Schools. I live in the Canby School District, and I'm here today to speak not only for myself, but for my good friend and co-founder, Tom Olson, who died Friday after 35 years of fighting battles for, for kids. I would tell you that he and I and many others are so grateful that this bill has been introduced. It is so badly needed. I'm not going to talk about the technicalities of the bill. I just want to say that Representative Fredericks hit on some really, really important points, and I think Representative Korshak too. This thing is happening in a context, and that context has certain characteristics. I'm talking about Common Core and maybe even beyond that. And the worst of all the characteristics, and I could write you a book and talk to you till midnight about how bad they are, but the worst one is, what is the hurry? Things are being rushed into place that will be echoing through when I'm long gone, long after that. What is the hurry? This is a very bad idea. I have a PhD in education. I worked in an educational research and development center. I've talked to all kinds of people in my own professional and personal circles who say, what? We need to vet these things. Don't involve a whole state and states in there. So I also would invite you to, first of all, if anybody would like to talk about the Common Core, I would love to talk about the Common Core. That's not why we're here today. But I will tell you that the Common Core should be seen as a train wreck soon coming to a state near you. When those tests are administered, you can look around. You're already seeing it. New York, things are going to hell in a handbasket fast, which I would really be enjoying, except that it's terrible damage to the kids and the teachers. It's so hard to clean up. So, anyway, have any other points? I'm going to have Betsy talk a little bit more about it. Our group has been working on the privacy issue for 2 years now, and we do have a member of our group. We're all volunteers. Nobody gets paid, but we have a member of our group named Lisa Schultz who has written on this and I believe knows as much as anybody in the United States about the privacy issues right now. Unfortunately, she's in New York today. I had to go back, and her daughter had a college emergency, and so she's not here. But I'm glad to furnish you any of that information. I guess just one more thing. I'm very concerned with the mentality we have about what's going on. People are just jumping over. My grandfather used to say, the old farm saying was, if a little will do a little good, a bunch will do a bunch of good. Not true, and not true in this data crazy world we're living in. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Betsy Salter. I'm a mother of an eighth grader in Portland Public Schools. And I also have 5 years of combined experience in Oregon Public Schools as a SMART volunteer coordinator, a Title I instructional assistant, and a math tutor. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 4062. Data privacy is one of the most important issues of our time. Over the last few years, as I have tried to follow the work of the Oregon Education Investment Board, my concerns about the welfare of Oregon's children is growing as I observe presentations with titles such as State Longitudinal Database System, Return on Investment Model, 40-40-20 Pipeline versus Adult Population. I'm very grateful to Representative Frederick and his colleagues for taking the lead on this topic that affects the safety and security of all our children. States around the nation are introducing similar legislation as a result of the weakening of federal privacy law in 2008 and 2011. House Bill 4062 is a sensible start to ensuring that our children will have the protection they deserve and reinforces the fundamental right to privacy that all citizens should have. It's a well-thought-out bill, and it deserves to be passed this session with all its protections. So thank you very much for acting to protect all students in Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to come testify. I did submit some written comments, and we are in support of this bill. So because I have submitted written comments, I'll just flag a few things that I've mentioned in the interest of time. So the first issue that's come up and has been discussed already is the issue of personally identifiable student data versus de-identified data. And I think you're all well aware of that distinction, but I wanted to underline it because we certainly are not opposed to the collection and aggregation of de-identified data. In some cases, it really can be helpful in ensuring education equity, civil rights enforcement, things like that. It's very helpful to know who we are teaching and how they're doing. It's when individually identified students are being tracked and in some cases on a very long-term basis that tends to rise up flags. And I think some of the issue there is that guarantees of de-identified data are not always very strong. In this context of identifiable versus de-identified data, it's important that the de-identified data is in fact de-identified and that it's not just really very easy sometimes to tell which student you're talking about, even if you're not referencing a name. So it appears that this concept is trying to get at that distinction, and I had the opportunity to just skim over the testimony from ODE, and I know we'll hear from them. I'll be interested to speak with them later to see if they have issues with the collecting or being sure to have the data be de-identified as quickly in the process as possible. So would love to engage in further conversations about that. And I think I just want to take the opportunity to emphasize really what we're talking about. It's been said here. We're talking about data being collected for one purpose and then used for another, really without, sometimes without the knowledge of the students or the parents, most often without their consent. It raises a whole host of questions, and at the ACLU, we like to think of this not just in the context of student records, but these issues of privacy and data aggregation and data collection are happening in government surveillance. They're happening in medical records. They're happening in all sorts of areas. And it was said earlier by Representative Frederick, the laws aren't keeping up with the advancements in technology. And so I ask you here today to take a serious look at Representative Frederick's bill, because we do think it's a good bill, and putting in some good details and sidebars on some of the requirements that are already imposed on the Department of Ed. But I just want to lay out for you what we call a privacy roadmap, so that it overlays really all of the things that you think about when we're looking at data collection and technology. And it's really kind of five basic things, and I've laid it out in my testimony that's submitted to you. But we're talking about usage of the data, what's collected, how is it used, when can it be collected, sharing and retention of the data, who has access to it, how long is it kept, is it being kept beyond the tenure of the original purpose for which it was collected. Control as the third thing. Do individuals, in this case students or parents, have the opportunity to take a look at what's collected about them and correct any inaccuracies?
The fourth thing is accountability. Are there auditing mechanisms in place to ensure that compliance with privacy policies is happening? And is the purpose for which the data was originally collected, are we achieving that goal with the very reason that we've collected it, our education outcomes improving because of the collection of and retention of the data? And finally, transparency. How are we as members of the public able to stay informed about the tools, the data collection tools that our schools are using, and what are the privacy policies in place? So I hope that you will kind of put those five basic things in your back pocket, and we'll continue to talk about that. And I really appreciate your consideration of this bill. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions for this panel? Representative Wisnant.
Real quick, just a yes or no. And it doesn't apply to this bill, but since it's come up by expert testimony today, does the ACLU have a position on Common Core?
Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnant, I really am not very familiar with the Common Core program.
Any other questions? Nope, seeing none. Thank you very much. Next we have Gina, I can never say your last name. Zeljic, thank you. I apologize. And Jan McComb and Doug Costi, please.
I'm so bad at names, and people call me guesswear all the time.
So I never want to get it wrong.
You have kind of a limited scope, okay. So you go first.
All right. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick, and I am Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Kate Brown, and there's Z's and J's and D's and K's in my name, so I get that a lot. I am here today on behalf of the Secretary of State as State Archivist and State Auditor. So neither of the directors could be here today, so unfortunately I probably cannot answer detailed questions, but just wanted to highlight a couple of the questions that this bill raises for us from those particular perspectives. So the first is from an archives perspective and enforcing laws on public records, retention, and all that that's spelled out in Chapter 192 and 191. Or maybe just 192. Anyway, and then and looking at the anytime it allows you to alter the official record, are times where that's not generally how things are sort of done thus far in Oregon. Maybe you do want to change that, but usually there is a process of redaction or other ways to look at and maintain privacy. So that would be one of the, so just taking, you know, anytime you make changes to the original are times where we look at and wonder how will that work, how does that affect archives, how does that affect our responsibilities going forward. And then from an audits perspective, audits can be obviously financial, and that's how people are used to thinking of it. Here in Oregon, we also now do performance audits that we've gone into many different agencies looking at much more creative things, and schools have been a big part of that. For example, you could look at, you know, does a particular approach to teacher training result in improved learning for students? And those records, while not disclosable or ever the personally identified information, never, you know, is very protected, is useful and vital to doing some of those audits. So they apply the same auditing standards to all of those, of course, but so some of those we're not sure, looking at this bill, exactly how that would affect some of the current practices we have, and I think are really valuable to education and looking and improving, using data in a good way to help students, to help teachers, to help all that. So those were just the two kind of bigger questions that were raised, and we weren't sure about the answers, so wanted to raise that to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb from the Oregon Department of Education, and with me is Doug Costi. I just think of him as our data and assessment guy, but he has probably a more official assistant superintendent of student learning title.
You have our written testimony, which goes into more detail, so I will just sort of skip over the section about things we already do to protect student privacy and just go straight to the concerns we have about the bill. Student privacy is very important, obviously, and we go to a lot of steps to try to protect that as much as possible, and Doug can talk about that a little bit. The wording in House Bill 4062, I think, might cause some unintended consequences, and we would like to work, you know, with Representative Frederick on tightening some things up. For example, if the records can only be used for the educational benefit of the student, for example, we can't help law enforcement when they contact us during an Amber Alert, because that's not for the educational benefit of the student. In terms of doing any kind of feedback to the legislature on the strategic initiatives, for example, without student data, we can't tell you if those programs were a success or not, because that's not directly relatable to the educational benefit of the student. The state got a waiver from the federal No Child Left Behind law based on the idea that, among other things, we would do a longitudinal database, and the wording in the bill would prevent us from doing a longitudinal database. Federal grants come to the state often with a requirement that we report back to them how well that worked. Did student outcomes improve? And we wouldn't be able to do that under the wording of the bill, we don't believe. Subsection 3I requires that student personal identifying information be removed from the student education record when it's no longer needed for the student's education program, employment purposes, or college purposes. And we get contacted by districts looking for transcripts, you know, decades after a student has graduated. They're trying to find their transcript. So we're not quite sure when that would be. Also, the Federal Family Education Rights and Privacy Act prevents the destruction of student records, so that would come into conflict with how the bill is worded now. And then just finally, the risk assessments. It has the department doing risk assessments on like every computer program that might include student records. So in addition to public schools and ESDs, school districts, the bill actually encompasses private schools as well, and there's some concern about, you know, our ability to go to St. Mary's Elementary and do a risk assessment uninvited, for example. Plus, even if we go on a five-year cycle for those risk assessments, that's still an awful lot of assessments, and so when we look at the fiscal, we're probably going to be contacting the Secretary of State's audits department, because they have more experience doing risk assessments, and it might be more appropriate for that function to be with them than with us. But we'll have to, you know, hire IT staff and risk auditors types of staff, which tend to be expensive, and it's very large scope. So our fiscal is probably going to be pretty big, and I just wanted to alert you to that.
Can you give a range? Is pretty big, like $25,000? Is last session I got a $450 million fiscal, which was embarrassing.
Well, if it puts at risk all the federal grants that we get, that would be probably in the millions. My colleague Doug wanted to respond to a couple of issues that were raised.
And could I ask you another question really quickly? So are you working with the sponsor of the bill in terms of wording to be able to address some of those common sense issues that might bring that fiscal down to something?
Representative Gelser, members of the committee, I did meet with Representative Frederick and say, I understand what your intent is here. It probably wasn't to do this, and so this language could be tightened up. In some cases, I think it might be more of a broader philosophical issue. You know, how should we use this data? And it might be a philosophical difference about the longitudinal database system. And so those are issues that, you know, I feel it's our job to alert you to, but if he is philosophically opposed to using data for that purpose, then he might not integrate those changes into his bill.
Thank you.
Chair,
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Doug Costi. I'm an assistant superintendent at the Department of Education and in the Office of Learning over the Instruction Standards Assessment and Accountabilities Unit within the Department of Education. And I've been doing assessment and accountability-related work since the early 2000s in the state of Oregon. And student-level data is near and dear to my heart. And while I really appreciate what Representative Frederick and others have put forth in this bill, it's as you can hear from Jan's testimony, there are some issues that we have to resolve. There were two points, or one point made during the testimony that I wanted to call your attention to. One was this national database. I am not aware of a national database where we're submitting student-level information to anybody. I mean, that is, for me, that's unheard of. We submit aggregate level of data to the feds through a program called EdFacts, but there is no individual student data collected or submitted to the U.S. Department of Education. So I just wanted to make sure that was on the record for folks to understand. The second thing is, in addition to some of the things that Jan brought up, I don't know how many of you are familiar with a report called the Entering Freshman Profile. This is a report we've done in partnership with the Oregon University System, where we share high school student data with the university system, with the public universities, and they match the data from those kids as they attend the first year. And the university system actually creates a report back to high schools that high schools find very, very, I believe, very useful, that provides them information on what their retention percentages and rates are, how well they did their first year, where they needed assistance, et cetera. And it's a value add, I believe, to high school teachers, and is a great example of something that we don't believe, with this language in place the way it is, we could continue to do. So I just, you know, wanted to call that out as a real solid example of something that could happen or could prevent us from moving forward with great research and feedback. That's all I have. I'm here to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Fagan, were you here? No. Questions for this panel? Really? All right. Well, thank you all very much. And with that, and I assume conversations will be ongoing. We have about a week to get this put together. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4062. I'm going to carry over. Do we have posted the work sessions for Wednesday?
Yes.
For the other two bills?
Yes.
And then we'll bring this one back later. So we have full agendas. I already mentioned that. See you at 1 o'clock on Wednesday. And with that,
Chair, what
yes,
you,
Representative
how many bills do we think we're going to see to get referred and things like that?
All of our agendas are posted now, aren't they?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, all of the agendas will be posted within an hour of the end of this evening. But they're about half posted, and then we're going to post, the committee staff will post the remainder.
But we had, Madam Chair, we have three committee bills.
We have three committee bills. We have a total of 14 bills in the committee.
Thirteen
bills in the committee. One is no longer needed. So we have 12 bills to work. Some are more complicated than others, but we are hearing every bill that's been referred to us. Right. I think any other questions before we adjourn for the day? Seeing that, and we are, colleagues, moving really quickly, so if you can read the bills before the committee, that would be great. House Clean Ed is adjourned.